and sips. His arms are completely paralyzed. He watches her absorb this information. She smiles, trying to mask her real reaction, a trench coat wrapped around her naked horror.
"Want to have a seat?"
He returns to the living room. "I don't recommend that one." He nods at the wheelchair. The melody in his voice is gone. Every syllable is the same note, softer in volume and slow, as if each monotone word is being dredged through molasses.
"You can still walk,"
she says, confused.
"Ah, that's my future. You have to order the chair before you need it, or I guess you end up getting it 6 months after you die. I told Bill they might as well deliver my coffin, too."
He laughs, but the sound of his amusement quickly turns into something else, a runaway choking wheeze, sounding nasty and villainous, gripping him tighter and tighter around the throat as if it aims to kill him. She sits a few feet in front of him, watching, a silent bystander, holding her own breath and strangely paralyzed, not knowing what to do. His final wheeze ejaculates a gob of spittle that lands on the face of his iPhone. She pretends not to notice as it oozes down the screen. She looks away, over her shoulder, back at the piano in the wheelchair. Richard's past and future. She thinks of all the time he used to fill learning, practicing, memorizing, perfecting, 9 to 10 hours and more a day. She looks back at Richard, at his useless hands. What on earth does he do all day now?
"Once you need that, how will you ever leave your apartment?"
He's on the fourth floor of a 150-year-old brownstone. No elevators, no ramps.
"I won't."
He'll be trapped inside this apartment, locked inside his body, a Russian nesting doll. She suddenly remembers the for sale sign out front. "So you're moving?"
"Trying. I can't afford a new place until this one sells, even to rent. Keeping me alive is already an expensive project. Might not be worth the investment. Don't expect any more alimony checks."
"No, of course."
She goes silent. The checking account balance, her meager piano lesson income, the monthly bills. She begins doing math, mostly subtraction, equations that scare her and can't be entirely solved right now in her head.
"How's Grace?"
"Richard, she doesn't know. She doesn't know any of this. I didn't realize you would change so much so fast. You have to tell her what's going on."
"I know. I was going to, many times. I just kept putting it off. Then my voice, I sound like a robot. I don't want to call and scare her."
"Write her an email."
Karina's stomach cringes, and her eyes widen, embarrassed. His hands. He can't type.
"I have speech recognition software and toes. I can still email. But she doesn't return my emails about school and the weather. I couldn't stand it if I wrote her about this and she didn't reply."
Given what Grace knows and doesn't know, it's not surprising she took sides. Loyal to her mother, Grace hasn't spoken to her father in over a year. Karina can't help but enjoy the victory in this allegiance and has done nothing to encourage an end to his daughter's Cold War. Karina looks down at the floor, at her damp socks.
"I didn't want to drop this bomb on her while she was at school. I thought it could wait
for the coffin to get here?"
Karina asks, transforming her shame to blame, an alchemy she's long mastered.
"Until she was home for Thanksgiving, to tell her in person. And I know this is dumb, but I think I thought if I didn't tell people I had ALS, maybe I really didn't have it."
4 months ago, she couldn't tell if he had ALS by looking at him, but now it's unmistakable. could he be in such crazy denial? Her heart tightens as she imagines Grace absorbing the news. This view of her father for the first time. This threat to everyone's well-being. She's not coming home for Thanksgiving. She's got a boyfriend, Matt. His parents live in Chicago. She's staying out there for the long weekend. We won't see her until Christmas. Just over a month away. Only a few weeks. Richard looks past Karina to the wheelchair behind her. His eyes well up, and he blinks repeatedly, working hard to keep his tears contained.
Can you tell her for me?
She considers his request and him, sitting opposite her, so vulnerable, a fragile bird with no wings. He's lost his arms. He's losing his voice. He's going to lose his legs, his life. She should pity him, this flightless, dying bird. But she doesn't. He's not a bird. He's Richard. She feels her posture harden, a familiar numbness.
No.
Her reply is cruel, but she can find no other. And the thickening silence between them is pressing on her walled-off heart, begging her to reconsider. She crosses her arms, steeling her resolve. She feels his eyes on her as she stands.
I have to go.
Okay.
Before you do,
she looks at him, trying not to see him.
Would you scratch the top of my head, please?
She takes a breath, crosses the impossible distance between them, sits on the couch next to him, and scratches his head.
Oh my God, thank you. A little harder. All over, please.
She uses both hands. Her nails are unmanicured, but they're hard and strong, and she rakes them all over his head, messing up his neatly combed schoolboy hairstyle. After a good scrubbing, she stops and checks on him. His eyes are closed, and a deeply satisfied, closed-lipped smile is stretched across his thin face. It's been a long time since she's touched him, since she gave him any kind of pleasure. Without her permission, a sweet memory massages an unhardened piece of her heart.
I have to go now. You okay?
She stands. Richard opens his eyes. They're glossy. He blinks and a couple of tears escape, spilling down his face. He can't wipe them.
I'm okay.
She hesitates, but then grabs her raincoat, slips into her wet shoes, and leaves without another word. As she's descending the stairs, she thinks of the many times she's left Richard, walking away in the middle of innumerable arguments, storming out in the middle of dinner, deserting him in a restaurant, leaving him to take a cab home alone. The last time she was here, marching out of his apartment after breaking his bottle of wine, leaving the courthouse on the day the judge declared their marriage irretrievably broken. The dissolution no fault, the divorce absolute. As she walks out the front door, fixing her hood onto her head, shoving her hands into the cozy safety of her coat pockets, she remembers walking down the courthouse steps, scared that it was she who was irretrievably broken, knowing there was plenty of fault to this failure, and daring to admit that she might be as much to blame for it all as he was.
Chapter 10. Richard closes his eyes against the muted morning light, wishing he could fall back to sleep, knowing he can't. He used to sleep through the night without waking, oblivious to the stirrings of his wife or whoever might be next to him, deaf to car alarms and police sirens and phone alerts. He used to sleep for 6 to 7 hours straight every night, lifting gently out of slumber into consciousness each morning with no memory of dreams or thoughts beyond shutting off the bedside light. He turns his head to see the time. He just spent 11 hours in bed, and he's exhausted. He doesn't sleep well anymore. With two lifeless arms, he's essentially stuck on his back all night, He can rock himself to one side, but it's risky. The last time he did this was a few weeks ago. His right arm became trapped at a painful angle under his torso, cutting off the circulation, and he had a hell of a time freeing it. And he can't risk beaching himself on his stomach. Because his abdominal muscles have weakened, he's not able to draw in enough air when lying flat, either prone or supine. Propped up on three pillows, he sleeps with his torso angled upright so that gravity can assist him with breathing. When three pillows and gravity aren't enough, the solution won't be four pillows. His pulmonologist says Richard will need a BiPAP machine likely within the next month. It's already been ordered for him. He'll have to wear a mask strapped over his nose and mouth, and pressurized air will be forced in and out of his lungs all night long. His pulmonologist says it's no big deal. The BiPAP is non-invasive. Chronic snorers with sleep apnea use a similar machine all the time. But to Richard, the BiPAP is a very big deal. And everything he needs feels invasive. The introduction of each new medicine, adaptive device, specialist, and piece of equipment comes with a corresponding loss of function and independence. The new medications for drooling and depression, the new voice-to-text phone app, the ankle-foot orthotic he's supposed to wear to keep his right foot from dropping, the feeding tube he'll soon need, the power wheelchair waiting for him in the living room, the BiPAP already ordered. Each one is his signature on the dotted line of a contract agreeing to the next phase of ALS. He's standing in a lake of dense quicksand, and every offer of assistance is a block of concrete placed atop his head, sinking him irrevocably deeper. And although Richard can't bear to talk about it, he's keenly aware of the last concrete block in the queue. When his diaphragm and abdominal muscles quit their jobs entirely, and he can't produce any respiratory pressure on his own, the final offering from his multidisciplinary medical team will be mechanical ventilation through a tracheostomy tube. 24/7 life support. Up to his eyeballs in quicksand, he'll be asked to blink once if he wants to live. It's 7:10, and Bill won't be here until 9. Richard has almost 2 hours to fill. Not long ago, it wouldn't be unusual for him to spend an entire day alone with his Steinway, perfecting the sonatas and preludes of Schubert or Debussy or Liszt. He'd begin in the morning, the sun streaming in through the bay windows, a spotlight for his private stage, and he'd be stunned to look up, seemingly only minutes later, to see his reflection in the darkened window panes. An entire day here and gone in a snap. He was never lonely when he was alone with his piano. Without the piano, 2 hours is 7,200 seconds, an anxious eternity. Torn between competing desires, aching to sleep and aching to move off his back, he spends several minutes doing neither. He turns his head to the side, pressing his nose into the pillowcase, and inhales the smell of freshly laundered sheets. He breathes steadily there, and the experience is heavenly, as sensually enveloping as walking into a bread bakery, but more specific, more personal. He can't remember the brands of detergent and fabric softener his mother used, but Trevor, who instead of managing Richard's career is now managing Richard's bills, services, and the delivery of groceries and household supplies, must be purchasing the exact combination Richard's mother bought. He inhales as deeply as he can, and just as the smell of onions sautéing on a stove puts him in his grandmother's kitchen, he's transported to his childhood bedroom. He's Ricky, 7 years old, and waking in his twin bed on a Saturday morning. He'll have bacon and pancakes drenched in maple syrup for breakfast before his piano lesson with Mrs. Postma. He'll play Chopin and Bach. His feet don't yet reach the pedals. Mrs. Postma loves teaching him. She sometimes gives him a pack of lifesavers at the end of his lesson as a reward for being such a good student. He likes the five-flavor rolls best. Cherry is his favorite. A feeling of safety and innocence washes over him as delicious as creamy hot soup, but it passes through him too quickly and without pausing. He's Richard, back in his adult body, in his adult bed, and he wants to cry for that little boy, for what he's destined to face as a man, for all that he'll lose. 11 hours of locked-up pain in his hips and spine intensifies, annihilating any hope of sleep, so he shimmies himself out of bed. He walks through his darkened bedroom. He can't draw back the drapes. He can't pull up the shades. He flips the bathroom light switch on with his mouth. Naked, he straddles the toilet and empties his bladder into the bowl, aiming with his hips. His stream is accurate at first, but then, as usual, goes astray. Before he's done, he sprayed urine onto the back of the lid, splattered it across the seat, and dribbled some onto the floor. He hears his mother's voice in his head. In a household inhabited by a husband and three boys, she was regularly scolding one of them about the god-awful filthy state of their toilet. He assesses the mess he's made, powerless to wipe any of it up. Sorry, Mom. He looks down at his distended stomach. He's not fat. Despite a steady diet of milkshakes, he's alarmingly underweight. His abdominal muscles have started loosening their grip, letting go. He stands sideways in front of his bathroom mirror and examines his profile. He's got the tummy of a toddler, the beer gut of an old man. He's also 5 days constipated. His neurologist recently put him on glycopyrrolate, an anticholinergic that decreases the secretion of saliva in his mouth and throat, so there's less drool, less pooling in the back of his mouth. Before going on this medication, he had several unrelenting coughing fits that carried on for so long that Bill and whatever aide or therapist was in the room believed that Richard might drown right then and there in a puddle of his own spit. Thankfully, the drug works, but it comes with a trade-off. Less spit, but full of shit. His overall lack of mobility and the mostly liquid, rather fiberless diet he's on can also cause constipation, but since this is a new issue, he's blaming the glycopyrrolate. He's also on Ryloxyg. It's said to prolong survival by 10%. Richard did the math. The average duration of this disease is 27 to 43 months, so he stands to gain about 3 months of life on Ryloxyg. A single bonus season. According to his most optimistic calculations, he won't see his 50th birthday. Not necessarily, people say. Look at Stephen Hawking, they say. Sure, the disease will paralyze every muscle he owns, but for those in his intestines and his beating heart, but he could live on artificial ventilation for 30 more years. This is the hope people want him to adopt, the inspirational speech aimed to fuel his will to live and persevere. Although Richard hasn't reached a definitive decision on a tracheostomy yet, if he had to choose today, he would rather die than rely on invasive ventilation. Stephen Hawking is a theoretical physicist and a genius. He can live in the realm of his mind. Richard can't. He looks down at his dangling hands. His world, his fascination, his reason was the piano. If he were a brilliant theoretical physicist with ALS, he might hope for 30 more years. As a pianist with ALS, he's not buying any new calendars. Hungry, he walks into the kitchen out of habit. He faces the refrigerator and tries to penetrate it with his eyes as if he had X-ray vision, imagining the food inside that he can't eat unless Bill or Melanie or Kevin opens the door and prepares it for him. His stomach growls. 2 more hours until breakfast. For some reason, he pictures the bottle of balsamic salad dressing in the door and thinks about its expiration date, wondering if it will outlast him. He imagines Trevor tasked with sorting through Richard's belongings after his death, fixing himself a salad, pouring the balsamic dressing over a bowl of mixed greens. Richard leaves the refrigerator and now stands in front of his bookcase, reading the spines of his books. He can't pull one from the shelf and flip through it. Photo albums from his various tours and concerts are stacked on the shelf below the books containing pictures he can't see of himself playing at some of his favorite venues. The Sydney Opera House, Roy Thomson Hall in Toronto, the Oslo Opera House, Merkin Hall, Carnegie Hall, Tanglewood, and of course Boston Symphony Hall. The cover of the photo album on top is blanketed with dust. He can't wipe it off. Programs from several hundred shows line the bottom shelf. There will never be another program to add to the line, never another picture to slide into the next clear plastic sleeve of his dusty photo album. This realization isn't a new loss, but he never gets used to it. He'll never play again. His chest tightens, and his heart and lungs feel sluggish as if filling with wet sand. Despite the glycopyrrolate, tears well at the back of his eyes. He coughs several times and steps away from the bookcase. He continues walking through his apartment. A tourist in his own home. A visitor at a museum, where he's allowed to look but not touch. He wanders over to his desk and visits the two framed photographs of Grace. Baby Grace with no hair and one bottom tooth. Grace in her cap and gown. Her long chestnut hair worn down, one of the few times he can remember it not in a ponytail. He wonders if she's wearing it up or down these days. He imagines the space between the two photographs. He missed so much of her childhood. His heart twinges with regret, wishing he could go back. He thinks of the framed moments he'll likely never see. Her college graduation. Her wedding day. Her children. He sits at his desk and leans in to get a closer look, hoping to see something in the tilt of her head, the light reflecting in her eyes, to absorb something new and lasting about her while he still can. The hunger within his distended stomach widens, aching for more than breakfast. And that single, lonely frame on his desk hurts his heart. There should have been more. When he and Karina were first married, he dreamed of a traditional family with great excitement. 3 or 4 children, a house in the suburbs, the regular hours of an instructor at New England Conservatory, and Karina teaching or playing somewhere. He hoped for a son, especially a boy who played piano or violin or any instrument, a young man Richard could inspire, mentor, and celebrate. He promised himself as a young man that he'd be a better father to his children than his father was to him. He studies Grace's face in the photograph, and his heart is pummeled by regret, anger, blame, and shame. He didn't live the life he intended, and there's no way to do it over. Maybe he's no better than his father after all. He blinks back tears and clenches his teeth, swallowing over and over, stuffing these ancient and new emotions down, absorbing them into his body. Richard's father was the quarterback captain of his high school football team, division champions class of 1958, married to the prettiest cheerleader on the squad, and Pop Warner coached to 2 of his 3 boys. Walt Evans felt no pride or joy in his awkward, skinny son who loved classical piano. He still doesn't. Real men love Tom Brady, not Wolfgang Mozart. Although Richard hasn't been back home in years, he'd bet that his brother's football trophies are still standing gleaming tall on the fireplace mantel in the living room, proudly on public display. His father is probably still bragging about Mikey's one-handed touchdown catch that won the Thanksgiving Day game against Hanover High. Richard's many piano competition awards were kept in his bedroom, hidden, private. If they haven't been thrown away or donated to the YMCA, they're now most likely in an unmarked cardboard box in the attic. Growing up, Richard felt his father's disinterest in him as disdain, disgust, dishonor. He's not sure Grace's experience of her father is much better. She had 2 highly trained pianists for parents, and no matter how he and Karina sold it, 0 interest in the piano. She loved sports, soccer and volleyball. Oh, the irony. For the first time in his life, Richard empathized with the disappointment his father felt in him. But he swore he wouldn't pick up the thread in the pattern his father had woven, that he wouldn't in turn reject his daughter. She could love anything she wanted, even if it involved nets and balls instead of strings and keys. He understood this. Yet her non-musical interests created real distance between them. They literally had no common ground. She was on a field or a court, and he was in a practice room or on a stage. The demands on his time, both rehearsing and performing, kept him from being home much, and when he was, he had trouble relating to her. He always loved her, but they were never close. Then he and Karina split. Karina lobbied hard for Grace's allegiance, disclosing all of Richard's many sins. He hated Karina for doing that, accused her of stealing his only daughter's love, and threatened to reveal his side of the story. But in truth, Karina didn't need a smear campaign to secure Grace's love and loyalty. Karina already had it, and pointing out the rotting heap of trash on Karina's side of the street wouldn't have served to clean up his. Hidden behind the photo from Grace's graduation is a picture of Richard and Karina on their wedding day. He almost didn't bother taking it with him when he moved out, and he almost tossed it in the trash when he needed a frame for Grace's graduation picture. He and Karina are holding hands and smiling in the photo, young and in love, assuming everything will work out for them. Oblivious. He thinks of how far they strayed from the life he wanted in that photograph, of what she stole from him, of the second chance at happiness that he'll now never have, and a wild anger snakes through him, coiling in the dark emptiness of his stomach. If he could use his hands, he'd remove that hidden wedding photo from the frame and rip it to shreds. He needs something to do, something to distract him from the bottomless sorrow and anger inside his gut, from the tortured thoughts circling like vultures in his head. He can't use the computer until Bill affixes Richard's head mouse, a reflective dot sticker stuck to the tip of his nose. Well, he could go old school and peck at the keys with a pen held by his teeth, or with his big toe as he did before getting the head mouse, but he doesn't feel like it. He considers watching TV. The remote is taped to the hardwood floor where he can press the on button with his big toe. Once the TV and cable are on, he can press the voice command button with his toe and say, Channel 5. He could watch CNN or PBS or a movie, but it's too passive. He wants to run, scream, cry, punch something, break something, kill something. Instead, he sits on the couch, powerless, laboring to breathe, staring vaguely at his pathetic reflection in the glassy black TV screen. He tries to imagine the life he might have lived if he hadn't met Karina, if he had 40 more years, if he didn't have to sit here alone for 2 hours with no hands, if he didn't have ALS. His breathing eventually settles as he stares and waits. He thinks of nothing coherent for a long time. He's playing Debussy's Preludes in the TV screen as he falls asleep. Chapter 11. Richard is awakened by the sound of a key at the door. He looks to his left wrist for the time, an obstinate and futile habit. He hasn't worn a watch in 6 months, since the fingers of his right hand lost the strength and dexterity to work the latch on the band. His eyes find the time on the cable box as the door opens. 9 o'clock on the dot. Ever punctual.
Morning!
Bill bursts into Richard's condo, whistling an upbeat song Richard doesn't recognize, jingling a metal ring of keys like a tambourine. The kitchen and living room lights flick on, and Richard squints against this assault on his senses. Bill puts something in the refrigerator, places an earth-friendly grocery bag on the counter, removes his hat, and hangs his coat on the back of one of the bar chairs. He's all movement and high energy, a diametrical contrast to the silent inertia he entered. He walks past Richard and lifts the window shades.
"Let there be light," he says in a dramatic stage voice, as he does every morning. "Where you at with the BM?"
"Nothing yet." Bill smiles and heads toward the kitchen. Richard can't imagine how this answer can be a cause for joy, even considering Bill's often inappropriate sense of humor. Richard assumes he must have misunderstood and is about to correct him when Bill pulls a small white bottle from the bag on the counter.
"This'll fix you."
Knowing that breakfast with a side of laxative is not the first item on his morning menu, Richard stands and waits for his Rilutek. Bill pops the pill into Richard's mouth, tips a glass of water gently at Richard's lips, and studies Richard's eyes as he swallows, watching for signs of distress. Richard gets the pill down without any fuss, and then follows Bill into the master bathroom. He doesn't flinch about being naked in front of Bill. Any modesty Richard had was pulverized to fine dust after their first week together. Bill's seen it all. He cared for his partner, who was diagnosed with HIV in 1989 through full-blown AIDS, Kaposi's sarcoma, and the pneumonia that killed him in 1991. The experience catalyzed a change in career from travel agent specializing in excursions to exotic destinations on private islands to home health aide specializing in excursions to exotic diseases in ordinary living rooms. On the books, he's officially Richard's morning home health aide, but Richard has come to think of him as equal parts brother, doctor, therapist, and friend. Richard wishes every day that he didn't have ALS, and therefore no reason to have ever crossed paths with Bill. But since Richard does have ALS, he thanks God every morning for this strange, beautiful man. God bless Bill. Bill turns on the shower, rolls up a sleeve, and checks the temperature several times with his hand before he's satisfied.
"There you go. Hop in."
Richard steps up and over the wall of the tub, less than 2 feet high, an elevation he's actually measured and is acutely concerned with. Clearing it already takes concentration and conscious effort. At some point in the coming months, his legs won't possess the strength to raise his feet over the wall. Maybe by then he'll be in a new condo with a walk-in shower, one he can shuffle his feet into while he can still walk, wide enough to accommodate a shower chair that can roll right into the stall when walking becomes a memory. If not, Bill will have to sponge bathe him. So many wonderful changes to look forward to. Richard stands with his back to the showerhead, grateful for the heat and pressure and touch of the water spraying his skin, one of the few moments of each day when he still enjoys being in a physical body. He pees. No mess to clean up in here. Just outside the open shower curtain, Bill is rubbing a dollop of shampoo between his latex-gloved palms. Let's have that gorgeous head of yours. Bill is bald and openly jealous of Richard's head of thick, wavy black hair. Richard is openly jealous of Bill's healthy motor neurons and strong muscles. Slightly taller than Bill, Richard bends over, offering the crown of his head as if he were being knighted. Bill works the shampoo into Richard's hair, and Richard smiles with his eyes closed, diving deep into this newly discovered carnal indulgence. Head scrubbing for Richard is a hedonistic experience approaching nirvana, almost as sensually pleasing as a blowjob. If Bill were an attractive woman, Richard's pretty sure he could climax off an intense head scrub. He channels every unresolved, agonizing itch he suffered through since yesterday's shower into the sublime satisfaction of Bill's nails combing the base of Richard's skull, raking the top of his head, scratching circles above his temples. The scrubbing stops, and Richard peeks his eyes open. Water is spraying past the open curtain, and suds are dripping down Bill's forearm. Bill adjusts the curtain and continues. He massages Richard's scalp well past the point of clean hair. Again, God bless Bill. He finishes and Richard rinses. Bill squirts bath gel onto a sponge, and Richard moves out of the shower spray to be washed, front side first, then back, rubbing the sudsy sponge along every inch of Richard's body. Bill sings, "They Say It's Wonderful" from Annie Get Your Gun. The whistling and singing drive Richard nuts. Bill is a Broadway buff and a karaoke fanatic. Every morning he belts out a medley of songs from every era of Broadway, from Porgy and Bess to Oklahoma to The Lion King to Hamilton. Richard sits proudly on the other end of the musical spectrum. He loves classical piano, the notes alone evoking powerful emotion, each wordless composition translating a privately interpreted journey. Listening to Schumann is like looking at a Picasso, like breathing in God. Listening to Bill serenade him with Broadway tunes is a fork dipped in vinegar, stabbing him in the eye. But Richard hasn't shared his distaste for Broadway with Bill. He figures it's not wise to risk offending the man who washes his penis. So he quietly endures every maddening medley. He's thought about asking Bill to play music from Richard's iTunes playlists. They could enjoy getting bathed and dressed to Bach's Goldberg Variations, Schumann's Fantasies, Chopin's Preludes. As there are no lyrics, this would shut Bill up. But Richard can't bear it. He can't bear to listen to the masterpieces of these great composers, the music playing in the practiced circuits of his mind, never again to be executed by his fingers. The exquisite agony in hearing the music he loves but can never play is far more painful than Bill's rendition of Everything's Coming Up Roses. So Richard tolerates Bill's singing. In a million ways, living with ALS is a practice in the art of Zen. Bill shuts off the water and dries Richard with a towel. The two men move over to the sink. Bill wipes shaving cream onto Richard's face, finger painting his cheeks, chin, neck, and upper lip. Bill stops singing once he has the razor in hand. Richard watches Bill's brown eyes devote themselves to every contour of Richard's face. Bill is breathing deeply and audibly through his nose, and as if it has its own gravitational pull, Richard finds himself inhaling and exhaling in sync. When Bill is finished, he wipes Richard's face clean with a hot, wet face cloth. "You look tired," says Richard. "Karaoke last night. I was up late." "With anyone special?" Bill hesitates. No. Anyone unspecial? I'll let you know when Ryan Gosling realizes I'm the one for him. Bill works some styling gel through Richard's hair and combs it. You lucky bastard. Look at this head of hair. Yeah, I'm the lucky guy in the room. Richard hears the monotone sound of his own voice, still unfamiliar to him. Every last syllable of one word bleeding into the first syllable of the next. Every word a single note played over and over. D, 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 D. Every sentence is the same song. It's the ALS anthem. Lullaby. Number one hit. You're not getting any pity parties from me, handsome. Open. Bill brushes Richard's teeth with an electric toothbrush and wipes the white froth off his lips with the now cold, wet face cloth when finished. The last step of their morning bathroom ritual is the arm massage. Bill begins with Richard's right arm. He rubs moisture cream onto Richard's shoulder, biceps, elbow, forearm, and hand, Bill's strong fingers sliding along Richard's skin, pressing into abandoned muscles. As with the shampoo, it feels like heaven to be touched. His right arm and hand are flaccid and passively accept everything Bill does. He wiggles and pulls on each finger. He holds Richard's arm, the elbow in one hand and the wrist in the other, and gingerly rotates the arm at the shoulder, circling forward, then backward, moving this frozen joint. He lifts Richard's arm above his head, dragging his fingers down Richard's skin, squeezing from wrist to armpit, trying to drain some of the edema that plagues Richard in this hand. His limp fingers look like tight sausages due to the fluid that seeps from his leaky veins, pooling in his hands. Richard watches this exercise somewhat detached, as if his fingers and arm belong to someone else. Yet he feels everything Bill does in vivid detail. Each touch reminds Richard that his arms aren't completely severed from his body, even though the efferent pathways are forever out of order. His arms are still connected to his nervous system, the afferent signals of pain, pressure, temperature, and touch completely intact. Somehow, this is comforting. Bill moves over to Richard's left arm. Although both arms are completely paralyzed, they look and act nothing alike. While his right arm is hypotonic, a limp noodle of skin and bones, his left arm is rigid, his fingers locked in a deformed claw. The spasticity in Richard's left arm resists Bill's touch as if in rebellious disobedience. Bill has to work hard to rotate the arm, to uncurl each stiff finger. Richard tries to will his misbehaving fingers to relax. He has no influence over them. Done in the bathroom, they walk to Richard's bedroom dresser. Bill knows where everything is. He chooses underwear, socks, jeans, and a gray crew neck, each with Richard's approval. Bill then dresses Richard like a parent dresses a small child, like a girl dresses a favorite doll, like a home health aide dresses a grown man with ALS. Bill pulls a pair of old loafers from the closet, and Richard worms his feet into them. Lastly, Bill loops the lanyard holding Richard's iPhone over Richard's neck as if it were an Olympic medal, clips the Bluetooth connector to his shirt collar, and presses the head mouse target sticker to the tip of his nose. There. Richard checks himself in the mirror. As always, Bill did a fine job. Richard is dressed and ready to go out as if he has somewhere to go, as if he'll ever be expected anywhere other than the hospital ever again. Except for the ghoulish hang of his arms, his protruding belly, the extreme thinness of his face, and the absurd sticker on his nose, he still recognizes himself in the mirror. He wonders if at some point he won't. They make their way to the kitchen. Bill opens the refrigerator door, that impenetrable vault, with an easy, unremarkable tug and begins pulling ingredients for this morning's smoothies. Richard's favorite recipe is peanut butter, banana, yogurt, and whole milk, with dashes of protein powder, flaxseed, citalopram, and glycopyrrolate. Today's special will include the addition of a laxative. Yum! Richard looks out the living room window. He knows from Bill's winter coat, hat, and gloves that it's cold outside, but the day appears sunny, inviting. He looks at his desk, the bookcase, the TV, the piano, exactly as they were earlier this morning, yesterday, the day before that,
the month before that.
I think I'd like to go for a walk when you leave.
Bill removes the lid from the blender and gives Richard a long, serious look. Richard hasn't gone out alone, unattended, since his left hand went dead.
I'd feel better if you waited for Melanie.
Melanie comes at 1:30, 3 hours after Bill leaves. Richard hates that he needs Bill's permission to leave his own home, but there's no other way. If Bill shuts the door behind him when he leaves, Richard is trapped inside his condo, his living tomb.
I'll be fine. Just leave my door open.
What about the front door?
I have my neighbor's phone numbers. Someone will let me back in.
Who's home?
Beverly Halfman should be around.
Bill approaches Richard and leans his mouth over the phone resting on Richard's chest.
Launch voice control, Bill says slowly and clearly. Call Beverly Halfman's.
The phone rings on speaker.
Hello? Hi, Beverly, this is Bill Swain, your neighbor Richard Evans' home health aide. Oh, hi there. Is everything okay?
Yep, everything is fine here, and he's going to go for a walk this morning. Are you going to be home to let him back in the building?
Oh, yes, I'll be here. I can do that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Beverly. Bye now.
Bill returns to the blender and peels a banana.
I still don't like it. If I didn't have my next client right after you, I'd go with you.
You sure you can't wait until Melanie?
I'm sick of being in here. I can still walk. I'll be fine.
You're wearing your brace.
Okay.
Bill makes 4 smoothies without singing, a sure sign that he's uncomfortable with this plan. Worried that conversation might lead Bill into verbalizing his concerns, and that might in turn convince him to change his mind, Richard keeps quiet.
Bill plops a straw into each drink and then leaves the kitchen. Richard steps up to the counter, bends his head to the straw of the first glass, and sucks the smoothie steadily down. He was so hungry. And while these drinks are thick and filling, they're far from satisfying. What he wouldn't give to chew on a steak, or even a piece of toast.
Bill returns with the foot brace and a winter coat, hat, and mittens, and squats down in front of Richard.
Familiar with this drill, Richard lifts his right foot without direction.
While holding Richard's leg to stabilize him, Bill removes the shoe, fits the ankle foot orthotic over Richard's sock, and returns the shoe to his foot.
Bill then threads Richard into his coat, pulls the iPhone out so it lies on top of the zipper, clips the Bluetooth connector to the coat collar, fits his hat on his head, and works his lifeless hands into the mittens.
I'm putting a key to your building in your right coat pocket in case Beverly doesn't answer. You'll ask someone to open the door for you, okay?
Richard nods, knowing this won't be necessary.
Okay, my friend. Bill dons his own coat. You're all set.
I'm still not a fan of this idea.
You sure I can't set you up with something on Netflix?
No, I want to get out of here. I know you have to get going. Let me just drink one more.
He finishes a second smoothie while Bill slips on his hat and gloves.
Okay, let's do it.
Bill opens the door, and they leave without shutting it behind them.
Richard takes each step down the stairs consciously and carefully, wanting to prove to Bill, who is walking backward in front of him and most certainly assessing the competence of every step, that he's perfectly capable of walking alone.
They pass through the grand foyer. Bill opens the front door, and they walk outside.
The air is face-pinking cold, but it's clean and breezy and instantly feels far more vital than the confined air Richard has been stewing in for too long inside. He takes a deep breath and sighs out the exhale. He takes in the passing traffic, the people walking on the sidewalk and in the park, a baby stroller, a bicyclist, a dog, a squirrel. He smiles. He's among the living again.
Bill pats him on the back.
You'll be okay. See you in the morning, Ricardo.
Thank you, William.
Before he sets off on his own, Richard watches Bill hurry down the street, an angel on his way to the next bathroom, bedroom, and kitchen, to someone with MS or cancer or Alzheimer's, washing hair and teeth and genitals, massaging and dressing and feeding, singing show tunes to all as he does, and for some, giving them the freedom to do as much as they can while they still can.
God bless Bill. Chapter 12
Three blocks from home, Richard walks through the gate of the public garden and is already exhausted. When he's simply standing still or walking from his bedroom to the living room, his legs feel sturdy beneath him, still capable and responsive, normal. At home, he can convince himself that ALS might only ever affect him from the waist up. Maybe he'll return the hideous $27,000 wheelchair that wasn't covered by insurance. But in his 1,400-square-foot one-bedroom condo, he's not asking much of his quads and hamstrings and calves. Three blocks from the front step where Bill left him, he's completely sapped. His legs have become sandbags, his bones filled with rocks, impossibly heavy, and he lacks the energy to move them. Even standing still is shaky. He needs to sit down. Around the bend past the statue of George Washington on his horse, Richard spots the nearest bench and tries to estimate how many steps away he is. He guesses about 30 and seriously wonders if he can make it. This is not normal. It's not normal for a three-block walk to wear out a 45-year-old man, potentially defeating him 30 steps shy of his destination. There's no denying it. ALS has crawled its way into the motor neurons that feed the muscles of his legs, and walking three blocks is the pathetic molehill large enough to unmask its sinister invasion. He imagines his body's resistance to this attack, the molecular war in the fight against ALS at every neuromuscular junction, an invisible army outnumbered and outgunned, deployed to fight this insidious enemy for as long as it can. The army holds its ground in Richard's legs when he is home, but when it has to divert half its soldiers to the mission of walking to the public garden, the resistance becomes compromised. ALS advances, and the enemy is poised to take control. His army calls back the troops. Every soldier is needed in the trenches. No more walking. But he presses on, every step a grueling punishment. He hears Bill's, Kathy DeVillo's, and his neurologist's voices scolding him in his mind. It's dangerous for him to keep walking when he's tired like this. His coordination gets sloppy. He's especially worried about the possibility of dragging one of his tired feet, stubbing a toe on the uneven pavement, tumbling him to the ground. With no arms or hands to break his fall, every wipeout is a potential head trauma, broken bone, and trip to the emergency room. 20 feet from his goal, he's fast running out of gas and faith. Still heavy, his legs now also feel flimsy, a teetering tower of wooden blocks that threaten to collapse beneath him with every step. His blood races through the vessels of his body, rushing through the chambers of his heart, begging him to hurry up and get to the bench before he falls. He looks around. He counts five other people close enough to hear him if he yells, but they might as well be in Timbuktu, because he'll never ask any of these strangers for help. And he'll never ask his father, or brothers in New Hampshire, or his daughter in Chicago. And he can't ask Trevor in New York, or his medical team at Mass General, or even Bill, who is somewhere with his next client. He is alone in the public garden. He's alone in his home. He's alone in his ALS, and he's suddenly, overwhelmingly, terrified. He can hardly breathe, but it's fear that's strangling him, not ALS. Each inhale seems to stoke a building terror, as if his blood now carries panic instead of oxygen. The fear grips his entire body like a vise, a cage around his lungs, more paralyzing than his disease, and he can't move. Sipping sharp tastes of air, he has to keep going if he's going to make it to the bench. He finds a pep talk, a mission statement. Keep going. He takes small steps, small breaths. His eyes are married to the bench, and when he's close enough, he leans forward, forcing his legs to keep going. It's the bench or bust. Keep going. Keep going. Two more wobbled steps, and he crash lands face first into the bench. His right cheek, shoulder, and hip already throb. He'll have bruises by morning, which Bill will demand explanations for. He rights himself and sits victorious, but feels nothing like a winner. The panicked fear flushes out of his system, leaving him rattled, wrung out, warned.
He looks back along the path he traveled and beyond the garden gate. A little more than 3 blocks and a long way home. Too many steps to estimate. Too many steps, period. Worst case scenario, he'll spend the next 2 hours on this bench. Melanie will call him at 1:30 and retrieve him. But he hopes for better than the worst case scenario, always has. He'll rest a while and hopefully recharge his leg muscles and courage enough to make the journey home on his own. The garden is tranquil this time of year. He spots a couple of ducks in the pond, but the swans and swan boats are gone for the season. The tourists are gone, too. The people walking by him are Bostonians, a young Asian man, likely a student, bent over at the waist, hauling a backpack thicker than he is, a woman in sneakers and a massive black winter coat carrying a large black umbrella, her eyes focused on the ground. Richard looks up at the clear blue sky, perplexed. A corporate woman carrying her dry cleaning with 2 fingers, the winter wind blowing the clear plastic sheath covering her hanging clothes behind her like a sail, her purse bouncing off her hip on the downbeat of every left step, her heels beating the ground in a half-time tempo, late for something. A short Italian guy, his stomach leading way out in front of him, gabbing on his phone in a thick Boston accent, his walk a swagger in expensive-looking leather shoes. Most of the people who pass Richard are traveling alone, stone-faced, white cords dangling from their ears as if they're robots powered by the devices they hold. No one looks at him. It's not that they see him and look away. They never notice him in the first place. He's part of the background, as uninteresting as the bench he's sitting on. A sparrow leaps onto the wooden seat a brazen few inches from him and tilts its head from side to side. They make eye contact, and then the sparrow hops to the ground. It pecks at something there and flies away. Everything living is in motion, going somewhere, talking, walking, pecking, flying, doing. Life is not a static organism. Every day, he's a little more shut down, shut in, turned off, a little less in motion, a little less alive. He's becoming a 2-dimensional still-life painting, slipping inexorably into the alternate dimension of the sick and dying. A woman passes him. Something about her reminds him of Karina 20 years ago, her long hair and that purple scarf. He met Karina in Sherman Leeper's technique class. Although he noticed her on the very first day, it took him most of the semester to talk to her. Fresh out of public high school in New Hampshire, he had no experience with girls yet. When he was a teenager, his father regularly discredited Richard's masculinity in obvious digs and under-his-breath derogatory comments. In a home in town where jocks ruled, a boy who loved tickling the ivories was seen as unmanly and decidedly uncool. Already cast aside by his father and brothers and boys in his grade, he couldn't risk adding more rejection from Jenny or Stacy or any of the other cute girls he had crushes on. Instead, he channeled his private feelings of longing and unrequited love into his playing. He devoted his attention to piano instead of girls, and he insulated his young heart from the pain of being judged weird or wrong or not good enough by pretending not to care what anyone thought of him. At Curtis, music ruled, not athletics. Every girl there was attracted to music, and even better, to musicians. Like a seed waiting for healthy soil and sunshine, Richard's confidence around girls blossomed at Curtis. That first day of technique class, Karina was wearing a lavender scarf wrapped around her long brown hair. He remembers her big green eyes and pale skin, her plump bottom lip distracting him from the lecture as he imagined how soft it would feel to kiss it. Then she spoke, called upon by Sherman Leeper. He can't remember the question, but he can still remember the sound of her answer in that Polish accent, her perfectly charming broken English. He sat there captivated, fascinated, turned on, jealous that she wasn't speaking to him. Her voice was a melody of exotic sounds and intonation, a song he wanted to learn. He loved the melody of her voice, but it was her fearlessness that he eventually fell in love with. At 18, she'd left her country, her family, her first language, everything she knew. Although his story was less dramatic, he felt a kinship in this. They had a common independence, a sense of no return, that music would be their savior, that everything was riding on this education. Curtis was Richard's path to freedom and fulfillment, and he found Karina on that same path with him, matching him stride for stride, holding his hand, smiling next to him. Their mutual passion for playing the music of Chopin and Schumann bled into a passion for each other. Their relationship at Curtis was heady and intense, their days and nights consumed in classes, lessons, practice, and sex. Richard sighs as the bitter memories rise up from the shadowed corners of his mind, dialing into vivid focus. He's surprised they held back from intruding for as long as they did. It's hard for him to visit those old happy memories of Karina without every horrible memory demanding equal viewing. In good times and in bad, the good and the bad, insoluble elements, prime numbers, oil and water, his good and bad memories of Karina don't blend, balance, neutralize or cancel each other out, and he's stuck holding both perfectly intact. Videos from his memory bank play. Their first coffee date in the student lounge. The first time they had sex. The last time they had sex. Watching her play piano, which was always feeling her play piano. Her green eyes loving him when he got his first big break, playing with the Cleveland Orchestra. Her green eyes hating him at the dinner table after they moved to Boston. The morning Grace was born, Karina's surgery, the day everything he believed unraveled, and too many emotions run through him. He's happy, in love, betrayed, heartbroken, overcome with lust, disgust, rage, regret. The release he needs is laughter or crying or screaming or possibly all three, which would be fine if he were home and not on a bench in the public garden. The people walking by will think he's nuts. He feels a little nuts. He needs to get Karina off his mind. He'll walk back home now. Walking will consume all of his mental energy and focus. He's standing next to the statue of George Washington when the laxative kicks in. A massive cramp seizes his large intestine, followed by urgent pressure, a 5-day late freight train barreling into the station right now. The pain and fear of losing control keep him pinned in place, unable to move, but he must. He's 3 blocks from home. A few steps onward, and the cold air against the sweat on his forehead makes him feel clammy, sick, as if he might pass out. He's not going to make it. He has to. He reinstates his pep talk. Keep going. 5 days of stagnant waste are now in motion, insisting on evacuation, and the struggle to walk combined with the struggle to hold it all in brings tears to his eyes. Keep going. Keep going. Through sheer will and some kind of a miracle, he reaches his front step. The urge to shit is now screaming full tilt, a peristalsis of feces and water churning inside him, pressing downward. He won't be able to hold it in much longer. Dipping his chin to his chest, he summons all of his strength and pours it into his voice. Launch voice control. Call Beverly Halfmans. The phone rings and rings and rings and rings. Hi, you've reached Beverly Halfmans. Please leave a message after the beep. Beverly, it's Richard Evans, your neighbor. I'm at the front door. Are you there? Open the door if you get this message. Please, I need to get in. End call. Shit. Where did she go? He presses her doorbell with his chin. No one answers. Unable to think of what else to do, he tries calling her again. The phone rings once and goes straight to voicemail. End call. He literally held his shit together with the promise to his body that he would relieve himself when he got home. He can't pull down his pants, but he imagines soiling himself in the privacy of his own bathroom. Now that he's on the stoop, he has no reserve left. His bowels have run out of patience and composure, and he swears he can feel the pressure in his eyeballs. He has nowhere to go. Public restrooms aren't an option. He has no hands. He could call 911, the lesser of two humiliating options. Wait. He remembers his other neighbor. Launch voice control. Call Peter Dixon. The phone rings twice. This is Peter. Hi, Peter. This is Richard Evans, your neighbor. Are you home? No, I'm in New York. What can I do you for? Nothing. Never mind. Thanks. Everything okay? Yep.
I gotta go. End call.
He remembers the key in his pocket. In his fucking pocket, and he can't reach it.